Well, they say stress is the reason why we find it hard to empathize with someone that we do not know. In separate tests in mice and people, empathy towards strangers increased when stress hormones were blocked by a drug. Strange story there. In a moment, Timothy Wilson joins us. We're going to talk about his work called Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Timothy Wilson with us. Timothy, of course, is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia. Got his BA degree from Hampshire College, his PhD from the University of Michigan. He is a social psychologist, and his latest work, Redirect, Changing the Stories We Live By. Timothy, welcome.
Thanks, George. Great to be here.
Likewise. Tell us a little bit more about you, if you would.
Well, I grew up in Philadelphia, lived here in Virginia for many years. I'm kind of your nerdy college professor. I have to tell you, George, I just got an email from my brother-in-law, and he had gotten one of those scam emails, one of the ones like, we have access to $30 million if you just send us.
Yeah, those Nigerian scams or whatever they're called.
Well, I'm Timothy Wilson, so I just want to assure your listeners that I'm not that Timothy Wilson.
That's right, the one with the $30 million, right? So you got involved in psychology, and you've taken it into different areas, haven't you?
Yeah, I think probably the thread that's common to everything I've done is about self-knowledge, how well we know ourselves, what are the limits on that, and the kind of stories we tell ourselves, that sort of thing.
All right, let's get into some of the things that you've done with Redirect. Tell me about that.
Well, it was a fun book to write. It's all about the stories that we all have about ourselves and the world around us. And everyone knows that, but everyone knows those stories can go wrong, that sometimes people end up with a negative view of themselves or too pessimistic. Maybe it's negative views of others. They're hostile, they're teenagers, they're rebels without a cause. And the book's about how to change these stories. That's hence the title, Redirect. How can we kind of nudge people into more positive views of themselves and others in ways that makes people feel better.
Is it your feeling, Tim, right now that people just aren't generally happy? And I'm not talking about everybody, obviously.
Sure. Well, there's more and more often there are happiness surveys being done, both here and elsewhere around the world. And in fact, even economists have gotten on the bandwagon here, figuring that not only should we measure a country's economic well-being, we should measure their psychological well-being. And they're including questions about happiness. And it's held pretty steady over the years, believe it or not, that most people say they're at least somewhat happy. Now, there's obviously exceptions, but in the United States, that's been pretty constant over the past few decades.
You've looked at the television program, the Scared Straight programs. Tell me about that and why the interest.
Sure. Well, that's a program that started in New Jersey a few decades ago. There was a Academy Award-winning documentary about it, and there's a current TV program called Beyond Scared Straight, where the idea is, it makes a lot of sense that if you take a kid who's on the wrong path and have him visit a prison, and those prisoners harangue him and tell him, if you don't walk the straight line, you're going to end up like me, and so don't do it. And it makes an awful lot of sense in a way that should help the kid, and he should go home and think, yeah, okay, I'm not going to join that gang or whatever. But it's one of these findings that you really have to put to the test, because once psychologists did that and randomly assigned some kids to go through these programs and some not, it actually does more harm than good. That it's a really consistent result that the kids who go into this program are more likely to commit crimes than ones that don't.
Jeez.
No one knows exactly why that is. I have my hunches that if you're a kid who, you haven't joined a gang, you're not that interested in it, but maybe you're kind of at risk, you're a lower socioeconomic, have a background, and now you see these people going to all this trouble to scare me It's almost like forbidden fruit. Maybe it makes it seem a little more enticing if people are going to so much trouble to tell me not to do it.
Well, when we talk about scaring people too, Timothy, look what's happening worldwide with these terrorist events and terrorist scares. Do you think governments generally are taking advantage of these episodes to scare the living daylights out of people for control or whatever purpose?
Well, you know, it could be. Whether they're doing it deliberately, I don't know. You know, I think back to George W. Bush. They would occasionally raise the terrorist.
I hated that, but color
warnings.
Chart.
You know, I forget the exact color scheme. What was it? Orange and red. And,
orange,
know.
Red. I hated it.
And you know, maybe they were in response to legitimate threats. The cynical side of me says maybe not, because there actually is some evidence that when you do scare people that way, they kind of rally and believe in authority and the president more. So, you know, I'm not quite that cynical. I think that's why they were doing it.
I think you're right. When you scare the population, you control them. They march to your tune.
Yeah.
Psychotherapy. Is that what you would consider yourself?
No, I'm actually not a therapist. I'm a research psychologist, but I know the research in that area, and I think psychotherapy, if it's done well, is really helpful for people who need it. There's some good evidence for that. The way I like to think of it is, in terms of this story metaphor, is that if people are really out of kilter, then it takes a bigger dose of story editing. You really need someone to help you revise the way you're thinking, and psychotherapy can be a good way to do that.
What makes somebody, I was just telling the story of somebody I know in St. Louis, 38 years old, a lawyer, nice guy, everybody liked him. He killed himself yesterday.
Wow.
Shot himself in the head when police, he was confronted by an argument with his girlfriend, so she called the cops, and they showed up, and he saw them, and he just pulled a gun out from under the covers and shot himself in the head.
Wow.
Why would someone do that? Now, some people who know him better than I said that they had seen something weird in his attitude over the last week or two. But my God, Timothy, what would cause somebody to do that? I mean, how could you be that unhappy to do that?
Yeah, well, you know, depression which is the cause of most suicides, is a terrible thing, and I've had family members who have suffered from it, and it's one of those diseases that I think is a really complex mixture of the genes we happen to be dealt when we were born and were conceived, and some of these difficulties in managing our thoughts, and no one fully understands that, you know, how that all interacts. But the sad thing is, there are treatments that can work. Combinations of drugs and psychotherapy really can help depression. But you know, it's one of those diseases that people don't like to talk about and don't like to admit they suffer from it. But it's too bad, because there really are some good treatments.
Subtitle of your book, Changing the Stories We Live By. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we think about these stories and, your friend's example, that we tend to think of them as, boy, sometimes these are deep-seated problems that might be tough to get people to think a different way. But there's some really cool, interesting research that says that not always. That sometimes we can tweak people's stories in little ways that have big effects down the road, and it can apply to all sorts of different things, from our own happiness to helping teenagers who are headed the wrong way, like in Scare Straight. So it's I call them story editing interventions, and it's really cool.
Can lives be changed? Stories be changed? Can they be changed?
I think so. And it may be easier at some points in people's lives when we're at times of transition, entering college, a lot of studies with middle school kids who are, you know, times when we're kind of rethinking things anyway. But I really think they can.
Explain a little bit more about that.
Well, let's take someone who's in their first year of college, and it's a transition time for everyone. You're kind of trying to figure yourself out and who you're going to be, and And sometimes those stories, they head south. You know, you have a couple of bad experiences in the classroom, and you may start telling yourself a story that, you know, I'm not cut out for this, that maybe I ought to drop out and do something else. I just can't make it here. And if that's your story, that can be self-fulfilling. You give up, you don't study as hard. But it's not set in stone yet. And so if someone can help and say, you know, maybe there's another reason for this, that you just haven't learned the ropes yet, or it's not that you're a failure, it's that everyone has to adjust to college and how to study. You're really a kind of a fork in the road with your story.
Sure.
You can go down the bad path or the good path, and sometimes it just takes a little nudge to get people down the good path.
Timothy, if you're a kid and you grow up in an environment where your parents are just constantly putting you down, I was very fortunate they kept building me up. But what happens to you when you become an adult, when you're in that kind of environment where they just, everything's negative?
Yeah. Well, you know, parents are one of our biggest sources of our stories. And, you know, it's funny, there's been a debate in psychology over the years as to how important parents are. And the pendulum kind of swings back and forth. There are some people who say, yeah, you know, it's parents don't really have that much of an effect. It's really about our genes. And when we get, when we become teenagers, it's all about our peer groups. And, you know, I think there's some truth to that, but boy, I do think parents matter. And one way they do is in just, you know, from the time we're toddlers, we begin to develop these stories about relationships and what they're like and what the world's like. And our parents, you know, have a huge part in shaping those stories. And they can be, you know, if we have parents who are really negative, who aren't very responsive to us, boy, those stories can be deeply held.
Do parents make serial killers?
Well, gosh,
I think they do. You're the expert.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert actually on serial killers, but that's a complex one. I'm sure that, you know, someone who's a sociopath or really has no conscience. You know, there's some interesting research suggesting that there can be some brain damage there.
Yeah, well, that's possible.
You know, concussions are often common at a young age, but parents can certainly add to the picture there.
Well, do we make the sociopath? Do we create that?
You know, if I had to guess, and again, you know, I'm not a super expert here, but I think it's some of them are born that way, and you know, it's like a lot of like my example of depression. That it's one of those things. It's a complicated mixture of our genes and our environment.
Well, how do you fight that then? How do you change?
Well, boy, if there's one story that's hard to change, to take a sociopath, that's a tough one. I think it's people are surprised that sociopaths can seem so normal in some ways, sometimes quite charming, and yet they just don't seem to have any empathy for other people. You know, there's something in the wiring there that's wrong, I think. Not to be pessimistic, but that's one story that's hard to change.
Yet I would say that most of the development of an adult happens in your child's life.
Yeah, you know, I think that's certainly true of core narratives we develop about the world. But I do think, you know, let's put sociopaths aside for a moment. I think for most of us, we can revise our stories to some extent. We can nudge them, you know, if we're unhappy or I don't think it's hopeless.
What's the biggest message you want people to get from Redirect?
Well, that there is some hope. That if people are unhappy, there's writing exercises people can do to tweak their stories, redirect them. as parents, I think one of them, as you say, one of our major roles as parents is to help our kids develop healthy narratives and stories. And there's some tips in there how to do that. So I really view it as a kind of an optimistic book.
Isn't it the case, Timothy, that most parents will treat their children the way they were treated as kids?
Yeah, I think, I know it's true of me with my kids who are now grown, but you do find yourself saying sometimes, I can't believe I just said what my mother used to say to me. there's some truth to that. And, there's some evidence that child abusers are come from families where they were
abused themselves. Absolutely. Yeah.
But, that's an interesting example because you might think that's something hard to change. But there's some really cool research coming out of UC Santa Barbara that shows that you take parents who are at risk for child abuse, and there's a program called Healthy Families America that does home visitation with such families.
Helps prevent child abuse, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the interesting thing is this program itself has been shown to be not all that effective, just to visit and give advice, until this psychologist at UC Santa Barbara added a little tweak to it, and that was to get these parents to reinterpret why their kids act out. That parents who are at risk for child abuse, it's kind of strange that they often blame the kid for acting out. They say, oh, he's fussing because he's trying to make me angry. And these home visitors were trained to just take that interpretation and try to get the parents to reinterpret. They'd say, well, can you think of another reason why he's crying? And they'd lead them down the road until they came up with an explanation that was didn't blame the kid. They say, maybe he's hungry or maybe he's just cranky today. And that little kind of tweak to their story reduced child abuse almost to zero in those families. So with a little help, people can change, I think.
World events, things that are happening right now, and everybody knows what they are. How much of a factor is that in one's happiness?
It certainly plays a role. I mean, particularly if you live in one of these countries a lot of political upheaval and there's a lot of self-help books that say we can all be happy. And I think there's some truth to that. But if you, you live in a world where, I mean, let me put it this way. If your daily life is really impacted, if you lived in Syria right now, that's tough.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's depressing.
On the other hand, there's some studies in the U.S. of how people felt right after 9/11, and
that was depressing.
It sure was. But oftentimes we're more resilient than we give ourselves credit for. It certainly had a huge impact on the story of what it is to be an American. But I wouldn't say it was mass depression for years.
Well, there's no doubt about that. And people want to get your book Redirect. How do they find it, Timothy?
Well, in bookstores and on Amazon. So
you got it out there.
Yep.
Okay, well, stick with us. We're going to come back in a moment and take some questions. Specifically, I want you to react to the question, of course, is what is affecting happiness? Is it the environment out there? Was it the way you were brought up? If you want to share that, go ahead. Tim's website, Timothy Wilson's website, linked up at Coast to Coast AM. It's part of his University of Virginia site. We'll be back. And we've got Timothy Wilson with us. We're going to take your phone calls as we talk about being happy. How does it happen? Redirect next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Timothy Wilson with us. We'll get to your calls as well. He is a social psychologist, PhD from the University of Michigan. Go Wolverines, huh, Tim?
Go Blue, yeah.
They didn't do that well this year.
Well,
they used to be so strong when Bo Schembechler was there. Remember that?
That's my era. Yeah, now you're talking.
Yep.
They just hired a new coach for, what, $6 million a year or something?
Now, you talk about being happy. That's not a bad coaching job, is it?
A lot of pressure. I don't know.
Hey, well, let me ask you about this. We've heard that money doesn't make you happy. Does it or doesn't it?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that we need enough money to meet our basic needs. So, you know, it's no fun being so poor that you are not sure where your next meal is coming from. No doubt about that. But once we have enough to feed ourselves and meet those day-to-day needs, not much evidence there's an added benefit. You know, that having, you know, fancy cars and big houses and all that stuff doesn't really add to our happiness all that much.
No, unfortunately, it doesn't. You know, some would say it's better to have it than not, because you can help a lot of people if you have it.
And, you know, another spin on this is maybe people just don't know how to spend it right. And there is some cool studies showing that if you have some extra money, better to spend it on experiences than things. So instead of buying that fancy car, go on a fabulous vacation with your best friends, and that'll have much, much more of an impact.
Sure will. Let's get some calls here. Let's go to Jack out there in Long Beach, California. Jack, welcome to the program. You are on the air with us.
Okay, thank you. If you could bear with me a few minutes, I have a few important things to say. Your guest was relating earlier to parents and upbringing, mm-hmm. and I can definitely, so refreshing to hear your guest touch upon that. From my experience, I can definitely relate to that. I'm originally back east, and I've been out in California for 8 years now, and I'm an officer. I work nights, but my dream job is to become an actor, and I've been pursuing that for the last 8 years. And in fact, tomorrow I'm putting on a showcase in Santa Monica. But with all that said, I came from a verbally abusive, sometimes physically abusive upbringing when I was raised in, excuse me, when I was raised in Ohio. And you can hear the inflection of my voice slightly change as I recollect the memory.
Yeah.
But, and I would also like to, quote a play at the end of this statement of mine. But anyway, what I'm trying to touch upon is the fact that any audition I've ever gone to, be it a minor part or a big part or anything like that, as I'm driving down the 405, I hear my dad's voice inside my head say, "What are you doing? What are you doing? You know, you're wasting gas. You're wasting time. You're not going to get it. You're not going to get it." And I have to deliberately shut that negativity out, because as a kid, if I was, and I'm in my 40s, and I've carried this with me my entire life, even through my military service and my law enforcement career, every aspect of my life has been impacted by my parents. And my mother, she would defer to my dad, and she was verbally and sometimes physically abused too, but she lived so long under that oppression, and they're still married, that she didn't even realize after a period of time. But it was combative. And so anyway, what I'm saying is, if I was going to go to an audition, I would either talk myself out of it or go to the audition and muddle through it and end up having a self-fulfilling prophecy saying, "See, you didn't get it. You didn't get it." When in fact I could have got it. And then
sure,
tomorrow at the showcase, of course, I have no fear. You know, I don't have a fear of getting up in front of people or anything like that. I just trust in my acting ability and my training, and just like I would in my law enforcement skills and my prior military service. But I've always felt, and I've talked to counselors in the past, but I've always felt that I've never got my parents' validation. And if I wanted to play like Little League or football as a kid or participate in a play, if I ever came to my father with it, it was always a hassle. It's like, "Well, I'm not going to pay for the uniforms. I'm not going to pay for the equipment. I'm
right.
not going to." And then I don't want to take the time. It was always a negative. It was never.
And I always burst your bubble,
I
didn't
it? I tell you, the last time I've ever gotten a pop, and even with the showcase, I even offered to fly my mother out to the tune of $600. And she said, "No, she's not going to come to the showcase, but she wants to see the recording." So I'm just saying, even in my 40s, my parents are still absentee. And even though they're coming up on their, they're in their 70s, there's going to come a time when, do I choose, do I put them in the nursing home and come and visit? Or do I be a devoted son and move back east and take care of all their needs? And I would honestly have to say no, not out of revenge, but just because out of apathy. But real quick before I finish is, there's a play. It's called I Never Sang for My Father. And it was actually acted by Gene Hackman back in the 70s. I think 1972 was actually in the theaters. And there's a closing line from that play and that movie. And it says something to the effect of death ends a life, but does not end a relationship, which carries on in the survivor's mind and struggles to find some resolution, which it never finds. And so that's an important thing, is that even if you have so much disgust or disdain or dislike for somebody, you can't even wish that person dead, because death ends a life but does not end the relationship, which carries on in the survivor's mind.
And it hurts you even more, Jack. Hey, Jack, I want you to give out, before we get to Tim's reaction here, give out the location of your showcase in Santa Monica for listeners in this huge LA area that we also have, if they want to come out and see you.
Well, we are located at the Ruskin School Theater over in Santa Monica, the Ruskin School Ruskin School of Acting in Santa Monica, and it's also the Ruskin School Theater. And tomorrow we're going to be putting on a showcase, and of course we've invited agents, producers, writers, directors, managers, and all of our friends and family. But we do have limited seating, and I just got an email saying that we're at 35, but we still have more room. It's a small theater, but we do have the theater in the school, but that's over in Santa Monica at the small Santa Monica Airport. And this school is very renowned, but the owner and operator, John Ruskin, purposely does not advertise, because he wants, through the osmosis, if you come to him as a student, or it's all about the acting and the training. It's not about...
And you're still you're still a current law enforcement officer too?
Correct. I just happened to be off tonight, and I took one day of leave from work for tomorrow, because normally I would be at work on Friday, but I'm going to be at the showcase tomorrow. Our call time is at 6 p.m. tomorrow, and you know, you're welcome to come, George. I met you before years ago on the Queen Mary, but one night when you were broadcasting about the haunted Queen Mary.
Yeah, I remember that. I'd love to get there, but I'm on the air tomorrow night, Jack. But let's get Tim's reaction as well. So you heard his story, Timothy. What do you think?
Yeah, well, Jack, thanks for calling it. And I think it's a beautiful example of two things. One, that parental relationships, they can last our lifetime, that they can imprint upon us a pattern that is tough to get beyond. But I think it sounds to me like you're also a beautiful example of resilience, that you have insight into this, you know the effect on you, and that's the first step to going beyond, and on your way to that audition, to saying, yeah, that little voice is there, but I don't have to listen to it, or I can reinterpret it. I can blaze my own path.
You know, my father, God rest his soul, Timothy, a wonderful guy, compassionate, just loving father to, you know, his three kids and everything else. But he would always drive me and push me to succeed or to do better than what I was doing, which was pretty good at the time. But his biggest issue with me for a moment was all my relatives were dentists, and that's what he wanted me to become. And, you know, Middle Eastern, that kind of custom family. So you basically, you know, didn't argue with your dad about stuff like that. And so I went to the University of Detroit to be a dentist. I did 2 years of pre-dental school. My love was always broadcasting and media and in theater. I just loved all of that. But I was going to be a dentist. That's what Dad wanted. And I did it for a couple of years, pre-dent. And I decided I'm going to switch my major, because I had some friends I knew who went to the University of Detroit, and they were in broadcasting classes, and that's what I wanted. So I switched it, and he would not talk to me for 2 months until one day he saw my name pop up as a credit on a television newscast for the ABC station I worked at the time. And that changed everything. changed everything. But he was the kind of driving father where, you know, I was the copy boy and he'd say, well, when are you going to be this? And so I would get to be that. And then he'd say, well, when are you going to be the producer? I get to be the producer. And then he'd say, well, that's great, but isn't there an executive producer's job there? I got that. And he said, but what about the news director? And it went on and on and on. Not that he wasn't proud. He just kept driving me for the next step. But he would do it on the day I got the job, the other job.
Oh, man.
That was tough.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the...
And now I can't stop. I can't stop working, driving. People who know me and listen to this program, they know. They know who I am. They know the ethic I have behind me. I can't stop.
Yeah, yeah. But at the same time, you are aware of it. You know that that's why you can't stop.
That's why I do what I do.
You know, having some insight on it is a really important step. As a college professor, I talk to a lot of college students and advise them, and you do see parents who just can't back off sometimes. They really want their son or daughter to follow this path.
Sure.
I remember one guy in particular, you know, at first he wanted to be an English major, and his parents said, you're never going to make anything of an English major. So he became a psychology major, and the parents said, you don't want to go to grad school in psychology. You know, that's nothing. You got to go to law school. So he went to law school, but out in L.A., as a matter of fact. And I saw him, and I asked him how things are going. He said, well, you know, I discovered my real passion is stand-up comedy. I've gone to these open mic nights, and that's what I'm really good at. And the last I heard, he was a pretty successful comedian, so I always had to laugh at what his parents thought about that.
But he had the last laugh.
He did.
Let's go to Rebecca in South Carolina. Hello, Rebecca. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Just want to let you know I love your show, and you keep me company every night.
Well, great. We're doing what we're supposed to do then.
Yes. I want to comment on what you were talking about, how parents' negativity affects their children. My father and mother both were very negative, and I had a very dysfunctional family when I was young and growing up. In fact, I never felt that I had the love that I needed, and I kept looking for it and looking for it all throughout my life. And I looked so long and so hard for it, it just pretty much ruined everything that I had ever tried to do. Like, that was the only thing that I could focus on, was looking for that love. I couldn't focus on the things that I would enjoy, like career-wise or making my life better. I was just searching for something that I couldn't grasp. But I had to step back outside of myself and pretty much put myself in my father's shoes to take a look at him and how he grew up, and my mom the same way, to understand what caused all this. And it wasn't until after my father died, I really feel like when he crossed over, that his spirit recognized what he did and how he caused my life to go downhill.
Hmm.
And I think he realized the forgiveness that I was giving him also. But he made contact with me. I'm a janitor, a custodian, and I'm in buildings at night all by myself.
I bet you clean everything perfectly.
I'm tops. But he came to me one night, and it scared me to death because you're in the building by myself.
Oh, yeah.
And I hear a voice saying, Rebecca, and it was so clear. It was over my physical ears. I'm like, whoa. So I think he was trying to reach out to me.
See, what's
and
so...
My mom...
Go ahead, Rebecca. Finish up. Go ahead.
My mom died last year, and the same time that she's in her passing into the next journey, I'm in the hospital with heart ailments and troubles and stuff. It's such a fiery exit of her life.
It's been coming at you like crazy. And in another example here, Timothy, where your childhood has a lot to do with the way you end up to being developed.
Yeah, no doubt about it. But again, I think the first step is to recognizing that. And Rebecca, sounds like you have forgiven, and maybe that's the first step to moving beyond that.
I had a story on right before you came on about empathy and what creates it, what is the lack of it. What are people like these days? I mean, do they open up doors for other people if somebody's walking up to a door with a box or something and, you know, you help them along? Are people a little more aware of doing things like that?
In my experience, I guess I haven't seen a big change. I think that your average person out there is a pretty caring person.
You know, I think you're right.
Sociopaths we touched on earlier. But, maybe it's because I live in Virginia, which is, a southern area. But I think it's true most places that people, they look out for each other.
Oscar's with us, San Antonio, Texas, and a first-time caller. Oscar, go ahead. Oscar? Oscar? Well, he's not there. He lost a great opportunity to talk to you. Let's try June in Alaska, though. Hey, June, go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about the difference between synchronicity and coincidence.
Sure.
I have two daughters, and one was born June 4 at 9:54 a.m., and the other June 6 a year later at 9:54 p.m., and their due date was born June 7, both of them.
Hmm. All right.
So you think, what do you think?
Interesting little take on that, too, as well, Timothy. So can people contact you through your website at the university? Do you take emails?
I do, and there's also a Facebook page for the book Redirect that people can post comments. Sure.
And what's your next move? What do you do next?
Well, I still teach and do a lot of research, so there's always new questions to capture your attention. Lately, I've been looking at why we all seem so obsessed with technology and why we can't just sit in a room by ourselves and
that's not going to happen.
And think.
That is not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we do studies where we ask people to do that, and most of them don't like it so much.
Not at all. Timothy, thanks. I really appreciate you being on the program to talk about this Redirect. Just fascinating subject. Look, we've got open lines tomorrow night. Of course, it's Friday, so we talk a little bit more about the unusual, the weird, the paranormal. I have not had an opportunity to talk with you about some of these world events that have been going on over the last couple weeks affecting all of us. We will do that next hour on Coast to Coast AM, Open Lines.